You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to another edition of the Daily Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and this is being recorded in the evening of the 12th of February, 2025. And I'm not sure how to characterize it, but this may be good news. Good news in the sense that for the first time since 1948, you have a serious debate amongst Jews as to whether or not Israel can survive for another 10 years, for another 20 years. Israel has been defeated. In Gaza, Hamas has gained all of its objectives, while Israel has gained zero. A year and a half, maybe a little bit more, the ceasefire agreement, poor though it is, has been signed. I want to stress on everybody that there's not really two sides, like, you know, Russia and Germany. Hamas isn't a side. It's not a state. It doesn't have an air force, a navy, has no diplomatic corps. Still, it doesn't matter. Israel has been defeated by these guerrillas. And given Israel's struggles on every front these days, including her fairly small numbers, this isn't going to change. Hamas and Israel agreed to end the fighting for now. As of today, it's holding, although I don't think Netanyahu has any desire to maintain it. But this is a multi-step pacification plan, allegedly to end the war. It was forged by talks mediated by Qatar, with some pressure from the U.S., although, given Donald Trump's unhinged comments, maybe that pressure is gone. But the terms of this deal are not favorable to Israel. This is why so many in the Zionist press has called it a surrender, including dealing with resignations from his own cabinet. He didn't want to sign it. He delayed. He wanted to get in as many airstrikes on Gaza. In fact, it occurred the same day he was going to sign it. That was the only reason for his delay. But really, just a few hours after that, the reports emerged that the agreement had been signed. Now, of course, this is not a lasting peace. We all know what this means. For the Arabs, the war can only end when Israel completely withdraws from Palestine and accepts the existence of an actual functioning, independent, and sovereign state. Not the nonsense that the Trump administration in the first term tried to promote, but a state with an actual economy, an army, navy, and air force under its own control. As far as Zionism goes, the only way this war could end is, it really depends on the success of the ethnic cleansing plan in the occupied territories, a plan that I think is purely fantastic. The truth is, though, that some of these Zionists are right. This is something approaching an Israeli surrender because the terms are very favorable to Hamas. Now, we have a prisoner exchange system, which is, as you know, Israel has tried to pretend these gaunt, thin hostages and prisoners, milking that. But the ratio, of course, is one Israeli for 50 Palestinians, plus the withdrawal from Gaza, stopping all further offensive actions, while Hamas maintains the political authority in Gaza, since it is an elected institution. And the only side that seems to have to concede anything is Israel. The winning side is the side that is in a position to dictate terms, and that is Hamas. I don't think peace can last here, but it also shows that Israel is bleeding badly. But given the nature of Donald Trump's absurd foreign policy, there may be less of an incentive to keep the peace from the Israeli side. I mean, somehow this depends on the good nature of the IDF. Given that Netanyahu is really kept out of prison by this five, now four-party coalition, his settler friends only understand blood. And what it comes down to is that whenever you're dealing with a military conflict, it is a political matter. It's a political battle that armies try to settle rather than diplomacy. The victor in a war is the side that achieves its goals, regardless of anything else. You can lose various battles and still win politically. We know all about this. The U.S. in Vietnam, the U.S. in Afghanistan, the Soviets in Afghanistan, Vietnam, Afghanistan in 2021, Washington was defeated, regardless of its superiority in military tech. They achieved zero of what they set out to do. Israel has destroyed the civilian infrastructure almost completely in Gaza, and still with that failed to achieve any of its goals. Its goals were at a minimum to eliminate Hamas, occupy Gaza, and to free the hostages. Again, another reason Israel has been defeated. If anything, Hamas is stronger now than it was in 2023, as recruits have poured in from all over the Middle East. Hamas has achieved everything they set out to do. They've weakened the Zionist enemy. They've drawn other forces into the war. They've exposed Tel Aviv's methods to the world. And they've even accomplished goals I don't think they initially set out to do, because they have crashed the Israeli economy. Now, the total final victory, the maximal victory, would be a complete reconfiguration of the territory. But even if the ceasefire holds for a short time, that's enough for these veterans of Hamas to regroup and strengthen itself. That the war is going to continue if it fails, but Hamas already has the advantage. Despite the slaughter of civilians, Hamas has prevented any real penetration of the IDF into its territory. It is holding, as of right now. But it's not just military, it's also been diplomatic, economic, and a political defeat for Israel. Netanyahu has no incentive. Well, he has multiple incentives, but the political ones suggest that he shouldn't be abiding by this, because his settler friends see this as a surrender pact. Three cabinet ministers have resigned, actually an entire party. I'm talking about the abominable Itamar Ben-Gvir and the Otzma Yehudit party left the coalition. It used to be five, now it's four. But not respecting the ceasefire can be just as damaging. He will be in permanent war, a war of attrition that Tel Aviv's in no position to win. I found it interesting that Netanyahu gave Donald Trump that gold-plated pager, the beeper. I'm not sure, you know, that's how the Mossad murdered civilians in Lebanon. Something tells me that Netanyahu is telling him that if you don't continue to, you know, if you're not a fanatical supporter, you could end up like one of these people. But these kind of stunts don't come from a position of strength. There's another level of this defeat. Israeli soldiers are refusing to continue the battle, and they're citing concerns, and in fact proving everything we've been saying for decades, not just for this war. They can't take the slaughter of civilians and the psychological toll that this unwinnable and genocidal war is taking on them all. There's a letter signed by 200 active duty soldiers saying that they're going to stop fighting unless this war is ended. Not a ceasefire. The war is ended. Now, if you have 200 active duty who are brave enough to sign their real names in public, then the total number of dissenters has to be in the thousands and thousands. One of them is Yotam Vilk. He's 28 years old. He was a tank officer. He said he didn't care. I know I'm going to be persecuted, but it doesn't matter. He killed an unarmed Palestinian teenager, and the guilt just ate at him. He said this was very typical. This was about dehumanizing the Palestinians. And Vilk gave his testimony, among many other places, to the Associated Press. And this is happening at the same time with this, you know, international pressure for the first time to end a war, and this is a complete victory for Hamas, that exposed the institutionalization of war crimes in the IDF. I spent a lot of time talking about the International Court of Justice, International Criminal Court, useless institutions, symbolic, but they have arrest warrants signed for members of Netanyahu's cabinet and Netanyahu himself. The soldiers are being put in a no-win situation, and this is why they're resorting to terrorism. Another guy, a combat medic named Yuval Green, 27 years old, he abandoned his post, and he did it after he saw an open looting policy. And this is right after his commander ordered his men, of course, being a medic, he didn't have to do it directly, ordered his men to burn down an occupied house on the grounds that maybe in the future it might be used by Hamas, which, of course, is a stupid catch-all excuse. And, of course, we all know that these are all true. These men have no reason to come forward. They're in a lot of trouble now. But this is an exposure of the Talmudic mentality upon which the entire country is based. I mean, Israel's always used indiscriminate violence against the Arab Goyim. They just kind of assumed that the U.S. and the media will protect them no matter what they do. But their allies are few. It seems that only President Trump believes that only Jews should be allowed to slaughter civilians. There's also a substantial crisis of desertion, and this actually even predates the present war. Very shortly after the war began, November of 23, you already had 2,000 acts of desertion within the Israeli media, meaning that the real number is much, much higher, and that that's increasing to such an extent that there's alarm bells in the government. And that was just at the beginning of the war, let alone now. Of course, they always had fairly strict laws against this, but they've increased it. Now, there was a lot of desertion given the protests against the judicial reforms of Netanyahu's cabinet. Now, it's coming from that and policies that they have to enforce in Gaza. The maximum prison term for this is 15 years, but I think they're going to increase that. As I've been saying for a long time, the IDF is so overstretched. They have a critical shortage of troops. The IDF is in a crisis. You've had operations abandoned because you have too much desertion. You have a breakdown of discipline in many places. As early as even March of 2023, before the war. But by the end of 2024, you have an increasing number of Israeli soldiers who have already done a tour of duty, who are refusing to return. They're depressed, they're worn out, they're damaged, and totally unmotivated. Actually, it was a Hasidic and Orthodox publication called Hamakom. Interviewed a whole bunch of soldiers and parents of veterans who were refusing to return. The Nahal Brigade, That brigade comes up quite a bit. They were ordered to enter Gaza for the most recent of many tours. Only six showed up. One mother of a soldier said this in the article. They returned to the same buildings that they had cleaned, each time trapping them anew. They've been to the Al-Zaytun neighborhood three times already. They understand that this is futile. It's pointless. They're a small team. They couldn't go out on missions. They just stayed there and waited for the time to pass. It was just unnecessary. And that testimony shows how badly that they're losing. They're losing ground. Israeli soldiers are destroying residential buildings, explosives, bombing hospitals, which is per policy. And of course, have long destroyed the water and electrical infrastructure of the Gaza Strip. And we've been talking on this show about Netanyahu talking about absorbing huge chunks of Syria and Lebanon. Where are the men going to come from for this? It's already, the IDF is already stretched way too thin. These kids are being asked to go on 4-5 tours of duty with no end in sight, with more territories added. In 2024, there were 6 Israeli soldiers who stepped forward to protest what they saw and what they were asked to do while serving in Gaza. There's a journal out there called 972. I've quoted them before. Their testimonies have been published there. And it just proves that what we've been saying for months. Commanders have authorized their men to open fire on Palestinians whenever they want. In March, Haaretz, the Israeli newspaper, exposed the kill zones. And this has come up a few times. These kill zones, we'll get into that more in a minute, but these are areas, central Gaza, where anyone stepping foot into it is shot, no matter who they are, without any warning. So you have Arabs, after the blockade that created this man-made famine, even this frantic search for food can lead to them being shot. Save the Children, that famous advocacy group, estimates that 21,000 children in the Gaza Strip are missing. And these soldiers said that the victims that they shoot are bulldozed out of view under rubble. So when the international aid convoys pass, they don't see them. The reserve soldier, who only identified himself by the letter S, said that the Caterpillar bulldozer, usually an armored bulldozer, clears the area of corpses, buries them under rubble, and then flips them aside so that the foreigners don't see it. They can't have images of people in advanced stages of decay in public. That same guy noted that the whole area was full of bodies, and the stink is extraordinary. Now, I grew up, I know what rotting corpses smell like. There's some mausoleums that are still, you know, I was in the funeral business. My father, as a kid, it's a disgusting smell. Not to mention the fact that rotting corpses are another vector for disease. Now, its open fire regulations are secret. In fact, in the 80s, there was a challenge against them to show these rules. But another soldier, who only went by the initial B, told the same publication that the Israeli army enjoyed total freedom of action. Any Palestinian approaching their position was shot. No warning shot. And he said, it's permissible to shoot everyone, young girl, old woman, whatever. He gives an example. Civilians were ordered to evacuate from a school that was serving as a shelter right now in Gaza City. Some misunderstood the order, and they exited right towards the soldiers rather than left. Of course, it's children. Everyone who made that mistake went to the right, was killed, 15 to 20 people, big pile of bodies. You don't have to do anything, according to this guy, to be a target. You can't even walk around. Anyone walking outside is inherently suspicious. He said, if we see someone in a window looking at us, you shoot. And this is why I say that that there's good reason to suspect the desertion and burnout rates are far higher than even these investigations have noted. But it gets worse. CNN, to which credit, last year did an investigation. And they discovered that those Israeli commanders, you know, mid-level officers, you know, captains, majors, whatever, that were identified by the U.S. as committing nasty war crimes over the last 10 years, not just in this war, that these are exactly the ones who have been promoted to higher positions. The Netzah Yehuda Battalion, who was a whistleblower there, spoke to CNN, said that these commanders are often drawn from your Talmudic extremist sector, amplifying the culture of violence towards the Palestinians. Now, there's nothing new here, but CNN's talking about this now? People have lost their jobs and have gone to jail in Europe for talking about this, and now Israeli soldiers are talking about it. The Jews have been suffocating Gaza with a siege for at least 17 years, and then act shocked when they're attacked. Of course, since 1967, Israel has been engaging in settlements, West Bank, East Jerusalem. I did a whole lecture on them. These are mentally unbalanced Jewish militias, heavily armed. Their sole purpose is to drive out Palestinians. They don't work. They're completely subsidized. And there's no rules of engagement there at all. After October 7th, of course, there was a loosening of the already loose rules of engagement. Mid-level officers were authorized to conduct airstrikes or to call one in, even when they anticipated very high civilian casualties. Now, the claim is that they would tolerate 5 to 10 civilian deaths per enemy operative killed. I don't know how, you know, whether or not he was enemy operative is another matter. But then they raised it to 20, and now over 100. This is how the IDF was able to target low-level Hamas operatives in their houses, rather than isolating them, you know, in the field. Making matters worse, they're using these 2,000-pound bombs, unguided, dumb bombs, in densely populated areas. This is why words like genocide are appropriate. There's an article in, also in 972 by Yuval Abraham about the role of artificial intelligence in target selection. There's a program designed to discover which of Gaza's 2 million residents are militants by a very questionable set of parameters, mostly Israeli stereotypes. All these inputs are very human. I don't know what's AI about it. Then this broad information is applied to individuals, and that in turn is traced to their family house. That means that every single person in Gaza has been under constant surveillance, meaning that it is an open-air prison. This is the Lavender program. Where's Daddy is the program used to find the house. During the first month of the war, more than half the fatalities, I think like, you know, 6,000 people, belonged to only 1,300 families, entirely wiped out. And that's according to the UN, because they're deliberately bombing homes. So you have these deaths of women and children, civilians, far higher in proportion than previous wars, even in Israel. Far more so than the 2014 operation in Gaza. Collateral damage was never figured into the parameters here. This is a mass generation of targets of low-level foot soldiers via these alleged characteristics and then brought to their home address. But they have other methods. The New York Times talked about the information from mobile phones in the Gaza Strip, providing the military with a live estimate of the number of Palestinians who fled the northern part southward. That was confirmed by General Udia Ben-Mua, who stated that, well, it's not 100% accurate, but it gives you information you need to make a decision. It operates, you know, it's a color system, red marks where there are many people, green and yellow mark areas that have been mostly cleared of residents. A lot of this intelligence, though, was incorrect. Homes were destroyed when the operative wasn't even there. Like it or not, This is the new way targets are selected and American tech companies are involved at every level. The proportion of women and children, I know I've said this before, are far higher here than in any other war in the area. Now the number, whatever it is, 100,000 Arab civilian deaths, you know that's extremely low. They were saying that a year ago. We don't know what it is. It's ridiculous. It's at least, you know, 300,000. But the Lavender Program had a hand in all of this, generating mass kill lists along with home addresses. This is the war of the future. Now, I mentioned the kill zone. Haaretz adds more detail to this. The Netzarim corridor, that central path cutting Gaza in half. That corridor is a no-go zone. Soldiers are ordered to shoot any Palestinian entering the zone. And bodies were never collected. And any time, you know, they shoot, all civilian casualties were routinely classified as terrorists. And the press would go on to say how many operatives are being killed. There's some competition to rack up body counts, but that will explain a lot of the desertion crisis, a refusal to return. Not just for the mass slaughter, but the fact that they're not getting anywhere. We know that Hamas has been victorious because a goal was to bring other forces into the war on their side, and Yemen answered that call. They have Russian-made hypersonics that Israel has no capacity to intercept. In fact, it was last year they launched one of these at Ben Gurion Airport. Regardless of what the press is saying, the Iron Dome system is struggling. You know, one of these interceptor missiles is $1 million at least. But even one of these, or even a threat of one of these, is enough to bring half the country into lockdown. That's how fragile the Israeli state has become. Yemen, the Houthi movement, the Ansarullah movement is absolutely heroic. And of course they've attacked Israelis, you know, they've tried to attack these missile bases in Yemen, on Sana'a, and have failed miserably. In fact, tens of thousands of protesters took to the streets to denounce the counterattacks. Ansarullah is a popular group, very pro-Iranian. Said no, that these attacks are only going to have us intensify. The only way to stop this retaliation cycle is for Israel to halt its attacks on Gaza. Yemen is targeting settlers. Sometimes these are the people who the press calls civilians. And there's been damage to settlements and things like that, but more importantly, it underscores the capabilities of Yemeni forces and created a psychological situation where settlers don't think that Tel Aviv can protect them. And this is going to continue. Abdul Malik al-Houthi, the leader in just a few weeks ago, said that this will continue so long as Israel functions in Gaza. Now, it was the 10th of January of this year, the U.S. and U.K. and Israel launched a coordinated strike on their missile bases. The very same day that large civilian demonstration was taking place. This was allegedly to safeguard commerce in the Red Sea, which has apparently been broadened to refer to destroying political rallies. But all of these have failed. Yemen has done damage to global shipping. Actually, a faction, a movement within Yemen has done damage. Given the ongoing certainty and the fragility here, shipping merchants are not taking any chances. The strikes have achieved their goal. They're damaging the already struggling Israeli economy. Now remember, they've only hit ships headed to Israel, despite the lies of the media. But the fact that they can't be rooted out, these attacks fail, that shows what the regime is up against. This is the axis of resistance here. They're a very difficult target. So you have a non-state actor imposing functional economic sanctions by selectively attacking international shipping. They have inexpensive, high-tech weaponry on the one side and a very strategic position. One of the busiest maritime choke points on the planet, the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, which connects the Red Sea to the Gulf of Aden and hence the Indian Ocean on the one side and the Mediterranean on the other. Where they are, it's only 14 miles across, Djibouti on the African side, Yemen on the other side. A few years ago, before the war, I'd say 2006, you had 4 million barrels of oil a day passing through there. So whoever controls that has tremendous leverage over the global economy. These are sanctions that actually have worked. Now, shipping companies, countries that have spoken against the Israeli offensive, they don't get attacked. And they make more money. Israeli ships, American, EU, they've lost the access to the Red Sea shortcut. Insurance has gone up, cargo fees, and everything else. The U.S. has failed to destroy these missile sites. A small, determined group can do tremendous damage to the regime. Again, not just showing the fragility of Israel, but the regime itself. Now, Haaretz has gone above and beyond. Now, Haaretz has always been an anti-Likud newspaper. For some time, they've been criticizing IDF policy. And they're the ones who expose, if you remember the attacks on hospitals that the regime was screaming was a lie, well, the Israeli newspapers said otherwise. They attacked the military for its attacks on hospitals in Gaza in an editorial, December 30th of last year, entitled "Leave Gaza's Hospitals Alone," talking about the destruction of the Kama Adwan Hospital. Five hospital staff members were killed. Now, according to the WHO, they say the operation forced the last working hospital in the northern Gaza Strip to suspend its operations. Surgery and the lab were set on fire. There was a pediatrician killed by the IDF. 350 people who were being treated there were forced to leave. There was an Indonesian-based hospital nearby, finance hospital nearby. The IDF destroyed that too. The IDF arrested the director of that hospital, Hossam Safiya, murdered his son, Ibrahim. That was a direct airstrike on the hospital of October of last year. Three Gaza doctors were killed in Israeli prisons during interrogation, why they were being interrogated in the first place. And all told, 1,500 roughly healthcare workers killed during the war. So initially, you had huge disruptions in healthcare services, but of course today, there is no healthcare. People who are supporting this from Trump on down can't be taken seriously on anything else. If they're talking about, you know, being pro-life or saving babies or, you know, supporting the family, and yet they support these policies, then you can't take them seriously. They're dealing with cognitive dissonance, which is not an easy thing to do, which, thank God, mean you don't have to worry about. I thought that everyone in the universe knew that hospitals have a special status during wartime. Any civilized country, the hospitals have to treat wounded from any side. And there's no justification for attacking it. Even if you actually have enemy fighters hospitalized there, that doesn't make it a terror base. And yet all of this has not dislodged Hamas. And Israel cannot take the area. The owner of the Haaretz group is named Amos Shokin, 80 years old now. He's been a brutal critic of the IDF. The Israeli government has condemned it, cut any ties with it that they had. He was at a conference in London and went after Netanyahu, and he called Hamas freedom fighters. Now, he was forced to retract this statement. Now, I don't know what that means. He obviously believes it because he had huge, you know, cancellation. And then the editorial staff, apart from the owner, had to write an editorial condemning him. saying things like this: deliberately harming civilians is illegitimate. Using violence against civilians and sowing terror among them to achieve political or ideological goals is terrorism. Any organization that advocates the murder of women, children, and the elderly is a terrorist organization. Its members are terrorists, and they certainly aren't freedom fighters. Now, I don't believe the editorial staff there. I think they were forced to write that. It is pure projection. That is IDF policy. It's just damage control. Remember, last July, that stupid joint session of Congress here, when Netanyahu talked about a total victory over Hamas, no one is saying that today. They've been defeated. Genocidal bombing, mass starvation, assassinations. I'm just talking about Hamas, let alone the Houthis or Hezbollah. You have people high up in the IDF saying that it can't be done. Former General Yitzhak Brick, and also in Haaretz, here's what he had to say about it. Every passing day, the Israeli Defense Force grows weaker, and the number of dead and wounded in action among our soldiers rises. If we continue fighting in Gaza by raiding and re-raiding the same targets, not only won't we bring Hamas to collapse, we will collapse ourselves. That confirms it. Israel has been defeated. They've underestimated the strength and tenacity of their enemy. It also suggests that the casualty rate of the IDF is far higher than anyone's talking about. Brick's assessment is shared by pretty much everyone in the IDF. The former Mossad deputy chief, Ram Ben Barak, said this: "It's evident that we are unequivocally losing the war. Show me one thing that we have won." He said that in Israel Public Radio. Major General Gadi Shamni, commander of, of all places, the military's Gaza division, said, "Well, our soldiers are winning every tactical encounter with Hamas, but we're losing the war in a big way." I don't even know if that's true, but Israel's own propagandists are countering the notion, even that this is a draw. It's not. Israel has lost badly. Admiral Daniel Haggadi, the IDF spokesman, said, "The idea that it's possible to destroy Hamas, to make Hamas vanish, that is throwing sand in the eyes of the public. Hamas is an idea deeply rooted in the hearts and residents of Gaza." That's very rare to hear that kind of realism and that kind of talk from a high-ranking officer, active duty in the Israeli Navy in this case. And this is why we say things like war is far more than dead bodies on the ground. The last thing I want to talk about is the economic toll. The economic defeat, and I'm not even sure that Hamas was meant to do this, but they have broken the Israeli economy. Thousands of Jews have had to flee border areas. Businesses are closing down in huge numbers. There is no confidence, whether it be investors or consumers. 150,000 work permits granted to Arabs on the West Bank have been canceled, so there is no construction of settlements or anything else, which shows that Arabs, poorly paid Arabs, something like serfs, the Israeli economy in the West Bank is dependent on them. The end of 2023, a few months after the war, 20%, a fifth, was removed from the Israeli economy. You have mass emigration out of the country, labor shortages brought up by total mobilization. A full third of Israeli manufacturers are operating at less than 50% capacity. By the end of 2024, the cost of living went up almost 40%. There is no foreign investment. And it's gotten worse that Israel now has clearly lost, and you have elites in the IDF saying that they've lost. The economy is collapsing. This is why you have official debates in real, either official publications or highly prestigious publications, debates as to whether or not there's going to be Israel in another 25 years. Back in July of last year, Shir Havir wrote the following: "The economic indicators speak of nothing less than the economic catastrophe. 46,000 businesses have gone bankrupt. Tourism has stopped. Israel's credit rating was lowered. Israeli bonds are sold at the prices of junk bonds. and the foreign investments have already dropped by 60% in the first quarter of 2023. And that was before October 7th. And there's no prospects of recovery. The majority of the money invested in Israeli investment funds was diverted to investments abroad, because Israelis don't want their own pension funds and insurance funds or their own savings to be tied to the fate of the state of Israel. This has caused surprising stability in the Israeli stock market, because funds invested in foreign stocks and bonds generated profit in foreign currency, which was multiplied by the rise in exchange rate between foreign currencies and the Israeli shekel. One of the worst things is a huge drop in population. You have a mass exodus of some of your best and brightest from Israel. The state, from 1948 on, is based on demography. They have to have a Jewish majority in most of the country or they can't function. That was the whole point of the Nakba, 750,000 Arabs driven out of Palestine. That's the acknowledged goal of the genocidal war in Gaza and why it's genocidal. Remember, before October 7th, hundreds of thousands of Israelis took to the streets to protest Netanyahu over the judiciary, etc. That issue hasn't gone away. But despite all of this, Netanyahu, who is totally reliant on the settler movement and its factions, is sending huge sums of money to totally non-essential settler colonial projects, diverting money that's desperately needed elsewhere. 14 billion shekels have been earmarked for those five, now four, political parties comprising his coalition government for Talmudic schools and the development of illegal Jewish settlements in the West Bank. But even after the war ended some of the judiciary protests, now you had mass demonstrations over the hostages. Now you have growing division between the Israeli government and the military over the goals of the war, none of which have been achieved. And Haaretz said the following: imagine what would happen when the masses take to the streets. Protesters will be presented as traitors, stabbing the nation and its soldiers in the back. The streets will be aflame. After all, the country has been flooded with automatic weapons and guns distributed along political lines, which is a reference to Itamar Ben-Gvir's handing out thousands of weapons to Jewish settlers in the West Bank. Democratic Israel is approaching the test of its life, and if we don't win it, we simply will not be. This is unfolding. Words like collapsing don't quite capture it entirely. You have mass demonstrations around the world. Israel's becoming a pariah state. Even Americans, as dumb as they are, find it very difficult to defend Israel any longer. I mean, only the most irrational evangelical, and Donald Trump, remains in Israel's camp. You know, Colombia produces quite a bit of the coal that Israel is dependent upon. Well, you have 28 countries in Africa and Latin America who have cut all ties with Israel, including Colombia. You know, that's it. This is the end, and you have many Israeli intellectuals saying this is the beginning of the end. Defeat may come in months, it may come in years. All of this was begun. Of course, it goes back farther than this, but it was pushed over by Hamas. I mean, you know, the clueless Zionist cabinet appointees in Trump's cabinet can draw out this offensive, but they can't change the trajectory of what's happening here. And I'm not sure if the new Kazadia idea to replace it, as odious as it is any better. I think that's too a fantasy. So much of Israel's life is subsidized by fat Americans, to quote Andrew Anglin. And this is fully well known. The point of Operation Al-Aqsa Flood was to overstretch the already stretched out security organs. They can't be maintained anymore. The regime's military, if Israel has these weaknesses, then they all have these weaknesses. There's cracks all over the regime here. From October 2023 to now, thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of settlers have been removed from the northern occupied territories. They had no right to be there in the first place. And many of them don't want to return. They don't trust the army, and the army's just not there anymore. Israelis are starting to learn that the government can't guarantee their safety. There is an exodus from Israel. Whether it's permanent or not can't be determined, but Israel is shrinking. Going back to, you know, the old Kahal in the old Polish Empire, the Israeli government's inventing stories about rampant anti-Semitism abroad. And the only reason they're inventing these stories is to keep Jews in Israel, but even that's failed. It's really hard to measure the total out-migration. Estimates are all over the place. But the Jewish anti-Zionist, Alan Pape, says it's about 500,000 as of June of last year. But that number was also used in December of 2023. I didn't get a chance to talk about Turkey. Turkey has severed all diplomatic ties with Israel back actually in November. They had a trade embargo in May of last year. They had some minimal diplomatic relations, but even that has ended. Israel cannot deal with Turkey. She has the second largest military in NATO, has the largest military in the Middle East by far, and the largest economy in that area. She's going to join BRICS. She doesn't seem to need NATO. Right after the war started, Turkey advocated for an arms embargo against Tel Aviv. And if Erdogan doesn't go along with this, he's going to lose office. Because it was in March of last year, his party was beaten badly in local elections by the New Welfare Party that campaigned exclusively on this issue. He gets punished when he doesn't take severe action against the Israelis. Now, there's not been a lot of analysis on this. What there is completely sophomoric. Turkey's defection is not something that educated Western opinion could really process well. Turkey's support has always been taken for granted, but it can't be anymore. Americans have been raised to think that Jews are this elite, superior, aristocratic people of the world, incapable of this level of crime. The notion that invincible Israel has lost the war, even that's going to take a while to be fully processed. Israel needs quick victories with full media support, and it's got none of that here. Israel has lost, and we're only now beginning to see what this means for the world. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I will talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.